Morning. Yes, I do want to get rid of that. Fantastic. But I do have something to share, something I prepared earlier. It's been a bit of a... See, this is really why I like... this is why I like paper more than... Anyway, in fact, we'll find out that digital things are a pain in the neck further on in the talk. So this is actually... this is dedicated to my dear friend and brother David Hulse. I served on eldership with him for several years, and he is one of those devoted, dedicated, loyal members of church who would be there even when he was dying. He's come to mind a lot. To him, church was essential, essential to discipleship. And he discovered that it wasn't the same way with others. And he was deeply hurt when people who he considered to be friends left the church, because he kind of thought they were family. And it bothered him. He thought, but isn't the church a family of God? Isn't it the body of Christ? Isn't it? Why did they leave? Well, they had their reasons, but he didn't seem to feel they were sufficient to leave. What really troubled him, though, and what I want to talk about this morning, is that he seemed to lose reasons to argue for church. I mentioned midweek in the email that there was, in 1989, there was a change to the Trading Act so that we could shop on Sunday. What a wonderful freedom, right? And I thought about that, and I thought, what happened where at once upon a time it seemed reasonable and right that you wouldn't shop on Sunday, and then something happened where we could no longer argue for that? It wasn't that the argument to shop on Sunday is so compelling, right? It's not so compelling, and yet what we lost was a reason to restrain it still. And what I saw in David, what I heard in his heart was, he knew in his heart, and sometimes you worry that, is this just habit? Am I just, I've got nothing better to do? Is that why I'm devoted to church? But he knew in his heart that church really mattered, but he could no longer find the words, even among other Bible believers, to argue for the importance of a local church and commitment to a local church. He didn't have that anymore, and it troubled him in his heart. So the reason I dedicate this to him isn't because he was one of those who shaped my life by his devotion and changed my thinking. But in fact, I think, had he been here this morning, and of course he knows already, right? He's with the Lord. The Lord's already shown him why the church matters to him. I think that this might have been useful to him, because I'm not going to say why the church matters. I'm going to instead talk about what has happened in our culture that has made it very hard to argue for it. Why is it that we, even Bible-believing Christians, find it very hard to line up our theology with what the Bible actually says about the church? Why we find it hard to find reasons for it? Something's changed around us and in us. Cultural ideas have infiltrated, and ideas start off as being novel, new, interesting, and then they become normal. And then they become internalized, and then they're not even there, they're just the way life is. That's the trajectory of an idea. We are at a place now where we don't even realize the ideas that have affected us, we just think it's how things are, and I'm going to talk about those things. Now, this has come from Christianity Today's Book of the Year for 2025. You want to put the presentation up? Thank you. Brad Edwards' The Reason for Church. And there's a very hard to read, probably impossible for you, at the bottom. Why the Body of Christ Still Matters in an Age of Anxiety, Division, and Radical Individualism. And I think one reason why a book like this becomes Book of the Year is because it's very topical. And what he is pointing to, others are finding very compelling. And so he starts off with, in fact, five what he calls church defeaters. The things that exist in our culture that have become not just ideas, but we've internalized them to the point we don't even realize they're ideas. We just think it's true. That are in fact defeating the church, or at least our ability to appreciate the church for what it really is, before we even get started. So we're going to share of his five. I only have time for three. And even then, I don't really have time for those. It's a pretty dense, in a sense, a dense set of ideas. The first one he describes as spiritual pragmatism. The idea, he says here, is that churches exist to facilitate my personal spiritual growth and help me fulfill my unique potential. Therefore, to follow Jesus faithfully may require leaving or switching churches for one that better meets my spiritual needs. I remember David being bothered by comments like something, I need to leave because I'm not being fed here. Or we are leaving a place where we can find, you know, our kind of fellowship. Or the worship is not really doing it for me. It's not really my style. Or there's not enough for my kids here. I need to find a community that they will grow in. Or my gifts are not being used enough. I need to find a community I can be useful in. They bothered him, but he didn't know why they bothered him. Now, do they seem reasonable to us? Do those reasons seem reasonable? If the purpose of the church is to help us grow spiritually, then it makes sense that we should move if we decide or deem that the church we're in is not helping us grow spiritually. And this is what Edwards calls spiritual pragmatism. Pragmatism means assessing something according to its usefulness or effectiveness. It's a very pragmatic approach. Is this useful? Is this effective? And of course, within ministry, it's not wrong to consider, are we being useful? As a preacher, I think it's important. Are we being useful when we preach? As worship leaders, are we being useful? Because of course, you might be being useless. So it's not necessarily wrong. It seems reasonable. However, for Edwards, spiritual pragmatism goes deeper than simply this. Spiritual pragmatism is the assumption that the church exists for my personal spiritual growth. Does the church exist for me? Because that's what it means. Let me put it another way, maybe even more provocative. Does God exist for me? The church is God's creation. It's his plan. It's his idea. It's his body. It's his bride. It's his temple. And yet, spiritual pragmatism among many Christians acts as if this is all for me. It's all for my personal spiritual growth. And in that mindset, feel fully justified, even righteous, in moving on. Would we act that way with our children? You're just not doing it for me. Before I had children, I had an idea of what they'd be like. You're not it. Would we do that with our spouse? When I got married, I thought you would change into the person I wanted you to be. I could see you were a work in progress. I just figured if I had enough time on you, why is it not working out? Would we treat our own body like that? You've let me down, body. I did some wood chopping yesterday. My back is aching. I could do with a better back, right? Would we treat God like that? You're not doing it for me, God. I'm going to find another one that will meet my personal spiritual needs. A lot of people are doing that. I am not saying that we shouldn't assume we will benefit from life in the church. I am certainly not saying that life in the church will not lead to personal spiritual growth. What I am saying is that when we come to the church with the attitude of, what does this place offer me? We are reducing the church to something that it is not. and we are distorting our relationship to it. Again, we could ask, is God good for me? Absolutely. He is absolutely essential to my life. Does that mean, therefore, he exists for me? No, you're getting it around the wrong way. More importantly, more rightly, we should say, I actually exist for and because of God. And if the church is Christ's bride, his body, his temple, is it somewhat provocative in our current age to say maybe we exist for the church, not that the church exists for us? It is about flipping that relationship so that we don't treat the church, Christ's bride, like a thing we might just get some stuff from. I think what David was really feeling was he was looking for a family and he found mercenaries. That's a horrible way to say it, but if you boil it all down, that is more the heart and attitude we're having toward church. Where does this, how does this profit me? And when it doesn't, I'm gone. Edwards writes, at the end of the day, spiritual pragmatism stunts our growth because the church is not a transactional organization, but is rather, like any family, a formative institution. Spiritual pragmatism can't help but undermine our experience of God's love and our belonging to him, because how we relate to church and how we relate to God are indelibly linked. That's how God made us. Over time, treating the church lightly in the name of taking our faith seriously will inevitably weaken our attachment to church and therefore to the ordinary means of experiencing the love and belonging for which we are fearfully and wonderfully made, which is his own. Every time we detach from one church, reattaching to the next church and restarting deep relationships becomes progressively harder. Every time we believe the lie that it won't be, that this time is different, we desensitize ourselves to familial connection. We make the deep community, horizontal connection between us, and meaningful spirituality, the vertical connection between us and God, we long for even more elusive. Now again, bear in mind, this is not necessarily saying that you are guilty of this, but rather if you are one of those people like David who wondered, am I the weirdo? I think Edwards is saying, no, you're probably not. You probably have somehow formed a resistance, and for David, I think it's long habit and training that he has a resistance to the cultural spirit that even though he didn't have a reason for it, he knew it was wrong. And he was right. So even if you read this and go, that's not me, great. Now you know why you feel so different. Because you're not buying into spiritual pragmatism. You do not see the church in those ways. Equally, we're probably all guilty of this to some extent. I know I am. Church defeater number two. The sacred self. As he writes, our next church defeater, the sacred self, is the belief that we, individually, are our own reliable source for truth and especially identity. Self-definition is an ultimate quest with our very sense of self on the line. To navigate that journey, we've turned our intuitions into a self-contained and self-protecting spirituality. Building on from the spiritual pragmatists who have, without realizing it, demoted the church from family to marketplace, we're now ready for that next step. What does spiritual growth mean for me? It's no longer up to the church to tell me what that is. It's now up to me. That's partly why people move around, all right? They've already assessed this church is not useful to me. On what standard? Their intuition, presumably. What their heart tells them. And the sacred self, I think if you found this, it's untouchable. If someone says, God said or God told me, conversation over, right? You know that. You are not allowed to challenge that because that is the most sacred, untouchable ground. God told me. Okay, fine. Okay. Must be true then. Yeah, how do you know? Well, because I felt it deep in my heart. After all, if it's about finding true self, then who can know that but you? Who can challenge that if they haven't seen your heart? And of course, when someone dares to overstep that boundary, what do? Well, we've got this entire industry called the therapeutic industry, which gives us incredible language to say things like, well, they've triggered me, they've traumatized me, I'm being abused, this is wounding, this is spiritual abuse, I need to create boundaries and keep people out. Because the sacred self cannot, it's above reproach, it cannot be challenged. I've made no secret that my favorite living theologian is this guy called Stanley Harawas. I think one reason I find him so insightful and refreshing and challenging is because there is one thing he is desperately not trying to be, and that is himself. He is a theologian, and he defines a theologian as someone who is trying to think another person's thoughts, not his own. He is not saying, what do I really feel about this? He is saying, what have people wiser than me before me already concluded? How do I begin to think as they have thought? And maybe I might become so into that world and understanding it, I might see something that might be useful to others too. He is interesting and seems novel and unique because he is not buying into the sacred self, spiritual pragmatists of our age. He says things that are, oh man, I can't believe he saw it that way, because he is not embedded in the culture that we're embedded in. That's why he seems so novel and interesting, because he's not trying to be. He's trying to be deep and real. If we expand that to the objective of Christian discipleship, we can, and I think I've said this before, borrowing from Harawas and expanding on it, that being a disciple is learning to live another person's life. It is learning to think another person's thoughts and feel another person's passions. And who is that person? Jesus Christ. That is the objective of Christian discipleship. Not to become the true me. Whenever that comes up, I can almost hear and feel Harawas shuddering and yelling out, God save me from me. The last thing I want to be is more like me, more grumpy, more self-centered, more prone to anger. Do I want to be more like? No, I want to be more like Christ. God, I come to the church to be saved from me. And of course, in that process, he is the most interesting individual I reckon you'd care to meet, because that's what God does. He creates fascinating individuals who are not interested in becoming themselves. So why does the sacred self, the search for inner integrity, to be authentic, strike a chord among Christians? Because it really does, and I think we can put a positive spin on this. I think we yearn to act freely and without compulsion in our love for God and others, don't we? Is the fear that if it's just a habit, is it really love? Is it really me? Is it really coming from my heart? Now, there's a bit of a false dichotomy going on here, but I hear it. And I think, of course, we all, and it's not wrong to want to act freely and truly from a heart and not feeling obliged or made to. And then certainly that's the heart of the gospel too. We're not forced to do anything. So here's what we need to do. What Christian tradition, dating all the way back to Abraham, we need to immerse ourselves in a community that makes Christ the central focus, that places us in the path of God's grace by being in God's family, so that we might, over time, have our minds and hearts changed to be more like him. Here's a story. Here's an example. Martin Luther King Jr. You know the guy? Kind of famous. The I Have a Dream speech, do you think that's possibly the greatest speech in modern times? I have a dream. Little girls and little black boys and little white girls walking hand in hand, or however it goes. That was one of the most important speeches of his life, right? He had a huge march that brought them into the Strand in Washington, D.C., and there he was before that enormous pond giving a speech to people, trying to inspire them, and it wasn't working. Martin Luther King Jr. was one of these most meticulous preparers you could ever meet. His sermons were carefully crafted, deeply researched and presented, finally written out. And the same was for any speech that he gave. Very rarely, and he would hate to be caught out, having to do something off the cuff from the heart. But the speech that he had prepared wasn't working. And there was Mahalia Jackson was on the side, the singer, and she was calling, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream." And it's something he had riffed on occasionally at different times and places, telling them about the dream that he had, that he had been nursing in his heart. And feeling that he had lost and was losing this enormous crowd in this incredible moment, he did what he never does, and he ditched his notes. And he went, which is what we would all long to be able to do, but from a heart that had been shaped over years of hard work. If you think that you can just stand up and give an inspirational speech without any preparation of life and character, you're dreaming and you're rolling the dice. But if you think that over years of practice and discipline and being in with the right people over a period of time, your heart would be shaped that it would possibly give a speech that would turn lives around. That is the contention. It is the opposite to the sacred self that says, the only way I can know what is true is how I feel about it. The scriptures and the Bible and the church says, no, you need to be reformed and transformed. You need a renewing of your mind so that you will become the person who from the heart good things will flow. But that won't happen without work, without the church. Which brings us to the third counterfeit, church defeater, counterfeit institutions. As he describes it, digital platforms bypass gatekeepers, hijack incentives, and manipulate user behavior to extract and monetize our attention at the cost of deforming individuals and unraveling society. Once upon a time, if you wanted to know something, if you wanted to do some research into a subject, where would you go? The library. The library. A valued, devoted librarians curated a vast body of literature of value to society. They did us all the favor of separating fact from fiction. Right? There were different parts of the library you could go to. And if you were either being mischievous or lazy, you put a fantasy book in the fiction section, the dutiful librarian would remove that and put it where it belonged. Because you shouldn't mix fantasy with fiction, with fact. That's not good. Crazy things happen when you mix fact with fiction and you can't tell the difference. It's called the digital age. When the internet was ushered in, it was called the information age. And who needs the censorship of the library? Who has to go all that way to a building to look at books when you've got it at your fingertips, all that you would want at your whim? Now, no doubt some good has come of this. Some good. But should we care that there is now no longer a separate category of fact and fiction for all the information presented to the world? Who is going to discern for us what we should trust as reliable and what we should enjoy as diverting entertainment? Right now, it's all blended in a smoothie and people are drinking it all at once, thinking it's this, Well, who knows what they think? Who knows what we think when we're consuming our online information? And the digital ecosystem is the perfect home of the sacred self, isn't it? Where if you really want to just express what you love, then you go onto into the internet and it tells you, what do you want to see? And you say, well, I want to look for this. It says, great, here you go. And how about this? You seem to like that. How about this? You seem to like this. You want more of this. Before you know it, what are you finding? Yourself. At least if you picked up a book in the library and we're about to present this as fact, the librarian could say, you know, that's from the fantasy section. That's not a reliable source of news. Who's doing that in our age now? In the digital ecosphere that our children are being raised in, uncritically fed information. And how do you even know that what is said is, this is real, is really real? But institutions, the reason why he calls them counterfeit institutions is because we once upon a time had institutions like the library that we trusted. But this digital ecosphere is undermining trust in these old pillars of society. Whether it be medicine or education, law and order, the church, the digital ecosphere is replacing faith in those institutions, but what is it putting in place? What is in place instead? There's no question that these institutions have failed. They are not perfect. They have had issues. But I would rather go to a GP who has been formed and trained by the institution of the medical sector, and who is under a set standard, whose role and job is to provide best practice for your sake. And if they don't, they can be censured, fined, maybe even seen to be criminally liable. Who's doing that for the online doctor? Which is replacing faith in the local GP. There was a case just this week in Nelson, a GP brought up before the health practitioners, parasitic infections for COVID, which, you know, where would you get that from? Well, you get that from the internet, which was awash with all sorts of crazy theories of what we should do for COVID. When I say crazy, I mean they weren't lined up with the institution. Now, we ditched the institution. What are we putting in place? 130 people showed up to support her in providing malpractice. That's how much our culture has lost faith in the formal institutions. But what is in place instead? Are they reliable? I mentioned when you go into the digital ecosphere, you open up your whatever it might be, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, whatever things you use, that over time, what looks back at you is just you. Just a reflection of you. Why? Because all the digital ecosphere wants from you is your attention. And it will show you whatever you want to have you stay and look. All it wants is your attention. It's free, isn't it? YouTube, don't pay anything if you don't want to. Instagram, Facebook, Wikipedia, I mean, they ask for donations, but it's free. No, it's not. It's costing me my attention. And that is no small thing. What is worship but what I am giving my attention to? What is worship but that which I gaze upon as being worthy of my attention? In the digital ecosphere, it's the place those who want to follow the sacred self, giving them every tool they want to do that. It's also the place that nurtures and fosters that until that's all they want to see. The church is the opposite. It's a place where you don't get given what you just what you want. You might not want to hear this morning, but here you are and you got it. It might even be for your good. Because I am not a digital ecosphere. I am not of the give them what they want category. I am of the institution of the church, which is I have an obligation before God to tell you what is true, whether you like it or not. To say that to myself, whether I like it or not. So that we might, over time, fix our gaze where it needs to be, on Christ. At the end of every service, I conclude with Aaron's blessing, right? The blessing that God gave Aaron to share with the community. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May he make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May he lift his countenance upon you and bring you peace. What is the emphasis of this blessing? It is that God is looking at you. That his gaze is on you. Ergo, fix your gaze on him. That the blessing from God follows where our gaze comes. If we are not looking at God, if we're not focused on God, if our gaze is not centered on God, we will not enjoy his blessing. We can't. Our back is turned to it. The digital ecosphere seems benign, but it is turning our gaze away. It is changing our hearts to not even want to look at God, to not even be in a place that challenges and rubs and makes us feel uncomfortable and causes us to sit boredly listening to a man preach. I would rather, who has not felt the yearning to look at their phone at some point? The other two, which I'm not going to talk about, as I mentioned, are uncivil religions, talking about the political associations that have replaced religion, and virtuous victimhood, which again is really interesting in its own right. If you want to learn more about what Brad Edwards said, because the first half of the book is just these reasons why we find it really hard to engage in church. The other half of the book is why church is worth engaging in. It's the positive side, if you like. Again, tying it back to why this is for David, he would often say, I just want to come here and worship God. That's all I want to do. And I guess he figured the church was the place to do it. And I think he's right. Yes, if the sermon was good, it was a bonus. Yeah. It might have been the case this morning. Yeah. Any feedback before we move to communion? Any thoughts? Yeah. Having, and I should throw the caveat in, of course, we are talking about, you know, healthy churches, you know, and a healthy community is by nature healthy. It's good for us. There are always reasons too why we must in fact leave a community if it's gone horribly wrong. Healthy community is good for us. Thanks, Jay.
Church is also a supernatural.
Yeah.
Jesus is here, the angels of God are actually here as well.
Yes. Yes.
The other thing I'd say is that the dynamic of churches have changed. It's important that Paul wrote the road to Colossae, to the church, which is Colossae.
Yep.
And if Colossae counted, it would be one of the 70 churches in Canada.
Yeah.
So people have crossed passing doors, passing 20 churches to come to this one.
Yeah. Yeah, so the two things that you mentioned, this is for the sake of those listening via podcast. the church is a spiritual institution as well as a physical one. It's overseen by Christ. It is infused with his spirit. The angels are present. There's a whole lot going in here in this realm that we do not see. The spiritual realm is a present reality, whether we see it with our eyes. And as you say, and I was going to reflect on this in leading into communion, it is astonishing to me how much Paul talks about communion and the body of Christ in such a scary way. You know, that because in that church in Corinth, where they were not treating each other well, Paul says, because of that, because of how you're treating one another and you come to this communion table in an unholy manner, don't you know some of you are sick and have even died? That is a very high view of church. Very high view of church. Yeah. Thanks, Mark. Anyone else? Yeah.
It's like family members saying, don't want to know you anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, thank you. So, agreeing with Peter, David feeling the same confusions and hurts, but in particular those who have been here for a long time, just disappearing and not feeling any obligation to explain why. I think one of the real challenges for the church today, if we're to be a church as God describes it, there's a huge risk. You don't know who sitting beside you sees their family today and turns out not to be family tomorrow. And acknowledging too, of course, there are times, circumstances in life that someone goes from being part of a church and not. It could be an illness, it could be they actually have to move city. There's all manner of reasons why someone quite rightly has to move from one church community to another. We're not talking about that stuff. I think it is really hard, and I've experienced this and I've heard it amongst others as well, with lots of church churn, those who stay become more guarded to become close to those who come. How do you form a deep bond and say your family and expose your heart to the wound? Now that takes, I think, a church to continue to stay close to Christ and say, well, if we get wounded again, so be it. May Christ heal us and forgive them. Because we can't become hard-hearted and not let new folk in and embrace them as family. In the end, that just impoverishes all of us. But I think that's kind of what happens within communities, why some churches are really big, because people don't want to bond that way. They're too afraid of the cost. And I know there's a lot of grief in this church from historic wounds. And many people in this church who are completely oblivious to that, and God bless you. But we can still, I think, dare to be family. I don't mind being the strange, slightly odd uncle at the party who says things that others go, oh, why did he say that? As long as you don't get rid of me. Yeah. Anyway. Cool. Let us lead into communion. I can ask a couple of people to bring the table forward. Oh, thank you.